setting off fireworks in my dog's car.
I'm leaving that.
This episode of that Star Trek podcast contains spoilers for Star Trek Discovery's latest episode and harsh language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, Sean, did you want to take this one since you're actually here tonight?
Nah, you can have it.
All right.
I did not prepare anything. I was just going to, you know, do my usual snarky bullshit.
You say that as though I prepared something.
Welcome to That Star Trek Podcast. This is your place for detailed analysis and speculation of all things Trek. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of That Star Trek Podcast, your one-stop pod for discussions, speculations, reviews, and other stuff. I forgot the fourth one, of all things Trek. I will try to take a lesson from Neek and write this stuff down like I know she does, but I do not. I am joined this week by a skeleton crew of old favorites. Going around the table, we have Rick. How are you doing tonight?
I'm waiting, Dr. Truffles.
And we have Neek. How are things?
I didn't prepare a quote.
That's okay. Neither did I. And finally, we have joining us once again, the big kahuna, the great bird of the podcast, the founder of the Infinite Potato Alliance. Sean, how are things?
This is not a Vesper Martini, but it is ice cold.
Nice. No one can see that, but
it's a fine. Blue cup full of Diet Mountain Dew. So there you go.
What a surprise. Diet Mountain Dew. All right. Now is the time, folks. We are going to discuss episode 4 of Star Trek Discovery Season 5, titled Face the Strange, written by Sean Cochran and directed by Lee Rose. Going to go around and get everyone's initial broad strokes take, what you thought of the episode. Sean, boss man, we're going to start with you. What did you think of Face the Strange?
I enjoyed this episode immensely. I think it's... Well, I mean, it's hard to say this is the best episode of Discovery of the season when we're only 4 episodes in, but it was a really good episode. It was a very Star Trek-y episode, and the only thing that would have made it better was if Chris Isaacs had showed up. Was it Chris Isaacs? Jason Isaacs, excuse me. Chris Isaacs could have showed up, too. That would have been all right, but Jason Isaacs.
Swing off my ship.
Yeah. Jason Isaacs would have made it much better. I think that we'll get into it, but the face-off between the Burnhams, it would have been fun to be Burnham versus Isaac.
We'll get into that later. Next up, that's Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Neek. What did you think of this episode?
I mostly agree with Sean. I thought it was a very fun episode, best of the season. It was extremely enjoyable. I like that every episode this season, they're putting in subtle Easter eggs. It's just a good time this season overall and this episode specifically. The only thing I disagree about is that I think it's the correct decision not to have Captain Lorca come back. He would have pulled focus. It would have been too big of a deal. So I think it was the right choice. I mean, I don't think they probably would have been happy to have him if he was available.
Yeah.
But I think it was nice just to have, you know, smaller characters return, like Bryce and Arium. I think that was the right way to go.
Had they opted to have Lorca appear in a cameo, it wouldn't have worked if it was just a cameo. They would have had to make it like the point of the episode from that moment forward. They would have had to find a way to make him the antagonist for the rest of the episode. Just one small appearance in one cycle and then jump to the next one. It would have, there's no better way to put it than, yeah, it would have pulled focus to make it just one scene. Such an incredible character from the first season to just get one little, you know, blink appearance and then it's gone, that would have cheapened it to make it so small. So you're right.
They could have done like they did with Doug Jones in that, you know, what we saw of him was probably just footage from season one, and then there was a voiceover for one line. If they had just had, like, instead of Stamets going, well, this is Lorca's ship, if there would have just been on the comms, you know, Captain Lorca telling Reese to meet him in the transporter room or something.
Like an audio cameo? Yeah, maybe we could have gone with that.
And then they look at each other and go, oh shit, it's that time.
Like Kelsey Grammer in First Contact.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. You've convinced me that a cameo on comms would have been okay. But to see him, to like film a scene with Jason Isaacs, I don't think that would have worked as well. But what I do think would have worked is if Rick told us what he thought of the episode.
I'm glad I watched it a second time. I'm glad I had time to watch it a second time, because I didn't like it the first time through. Actually, that's not entirely true. I enjoyed it the first time through, but afterwards, I was like, this was just magic to make the sane man go mad over again without Harry Mudd in there. And I just chewed on that thought for 3 days, and I almost didn't rewatch it. And then I finally was like, I've got time. I've got to rewatch it. And I'm glad I did, because it wasn't. I got that idea in my head and couldn't let go of it. But I really enjoyed it. And let me just clarify, I didn't even think about Lorca showing up. They mentioned him. Okay, there we are. They also said he was off the ship. That was fine. It was fine. It was kind of a very complicated way to show that what Burnham did to Rayner last week was justified. But overall, I enjoyed it. It was much better a second time through as well.
I only got the opportunity to watch it the one time, so I wasn't able to go back and review the first half, three quarters of the episode, knowing how it ends. But I also enjoyed it. I don't know if I'm going to say it was the best episode of the season. Because again, it is fairly early in the season, and I didn't really have a lot of problems with the first three episodes. Now, I really have no recollection of what I said on our first episode of the season when we discussed the first two. So if I had huge problems with them, I've forgotten them, and now they're fine episodes for me now. This one, it was enjoyable. I like little time jumping romps. I was also getting flashes of whatever the title of that first season episode was that I've already forgotten.
Magic to make the same man go mad. Yeah.
I was getting flashes of that, but I liked that it was jumping to different points in the past and future and different locations, and not just the same loop repeating itself. So it was,
yeah, I don't see, I mean, I understand why you're comparing it to that Mud episode, because it's, you know, a disco time jumping episode. But this episode was actually much closer to some, like there's an episode of Voyager where Chakotay goes through something similar, where he's jumping around at different times during his service on Voyager. It was much closer to that one.
Yeah, that first season episode was a time loop. That was a time loop episode.
Yeah.
And this was just totally kind of randomly jumping around.
Time jump, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was still Michael teaming up with Stamets, because Stamets was time special. So it had that similarity.
Part, and it was like, you know, meet me on deck 13 every time this happens. You know, and I know there were significant differences between the two episodes, but overall, you know, they could be,
if you had
a file of types.
Yeah, we'll call it a spiritual successor, this episode.
I almost feel like this episode is like an apology for that one, because I've said it many times, what I hated about that Mud one is that it was treated like a comedy centered around a mass murderer who's not just, you know, accidentally killing, who's very malevolent and sociopathic about it. And so to treat that as funny was, to me, deeply offensive. So this one being cute and a romp is fine because, like, no one's doing anything sinister except for Locke and Maul, and they're not really in it. So I was fine with it. It was almost like a redemption for Disco doing this type of story.
Yeah, I do agree. Well, of course, I almost always agree with what Neek says because Neek is very, very smart.
Except when you disagree.
Except when I disagree. It was a very enjoyable episode. I found myself almost rolling my eyes a couple times at the very, almost comedically heavy-handed way that they were showing us the lesson, even to the point where,
yes,
like by the end of the episode, Rainer and Michael are having a conversation about, this is the lesson of the episode, in case it wasn't made abundantly clear over the last 49 minutes. The lesson of the episode was,
yeah,
this.
And you laid it out at the beginning.
You saw it unfold in front of your eyes, and now we are discussing the lesson. That is the lesson.
Well, that's it, which was a complete echo of last week, where it was the exact same thing, where it was so heavy-handed, and now this one is an extension of that one. It's the same lesson.
Yeah, because, well, they only had time for Rainer to show up at the bar and talk with Tilly and prove, look, I was listening, and I learned important things from those brief conversations. So there was some good to come from it. And she's like, yeah, but you gotta, like, mean it. And he's like, maybe. And that's all they had time for. So in this episode, he had to actually put that information
into
to
practice.
Use,
yeah,
to save the day. So,
yeah, there was a couple of scenes where he like when he ran into Reno in the hallway, and then you could see on his face, it's like, okay, I underestimated you. I'm very impressed with you now.
And like, I don't mind him learning that lesson, and I don't mind it taking him multiple episodes to learn a lesson, because in real life, most people never learn whatever lessons they're meant to learn. So that's fine. But it's the heavy-handedness. I mean, my God, was this written for toddlers? Like, it was so... I mean, I guess Star Trek, you know, has never been particularly subtle, but still, this was like... Dear God, they hired a skywriter for this one.
And yeah, my only problem with this whole Rainer needs to learn a lesson about communicating with people is, like, he's not some guy that just, I mean, he was a captain, mm-hmm, and a pretty successful one, you know, that it's not like he's brand new to all this. I mean, you can't run a starship without already knowing some of this stuff. I think they should kind of insinuate that he knows this stuff, he just kind of forgot it along the way or something like that, instead of acting like this is all brand new lessons that he's learning or whatever.
Yeah, I agree. It's condescending to someone who presumably has done this job before. If he's a captain, it means at some point he was a commander. Mm-hmm. So, like, it is a bit bizarre that he would have to learn these lessons, as it were. Like, why is his, presumably his way of doing things worked, so therefore it's valid. So it's not like the lessons are wrong, but it's just so over the top. Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah. I have one word for Rainer: Jellico.
I knew you were about to say that.
That's
another thing. See, Jellico was right, though. Jellico wasn't. He was just.
I don't think Jellico was right. Riker was wrong, but that's a different discussion.
He was used as a bad guy, not a bad guy, but like an adversary in that episode or whatever. But a lot of the stuff that he said was like, "Yeah, Deanna, put your clothes on," you know.
we're not going to get into this discussion again. We've had it before.
But the point I'm making is that you can be a successful captain and be a douche as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's what they're trying to get Rainer to become more like Michael. I just had a flash of rampant speculation that I wonder if at the end of this season, assuming Rainer survives, if it's not going to be, he's finally, you know, his heart grew five times its size or whatever, and he took off his Grinch costume, and he's going to end up being captain of Discovery, and Michael's going to go off on some bye-bye adventure or something. I don't know. She and Book are going to have happily ever after or something like that. Because they're putting an awful lot of work into making him a nice guy.
Yeah. They put a lot of work into making Stamets a nice guy. It's like the show is all about teaching people to be nice and emotional and, you know, sorry, but woke. So, but I feel like it would diminish Michael to have her no longer be captain, no?
I don't know. I'm not saying that's what I want to happen. That's just a thought that occurred to me.
Yeah, they said they had to go back and do a lot of reshoots for the finale to make it a serious finale. So they, I don't know if that's one of the things that they did. It's like, we've got to give Michael an end to her story, you know, because this is, this whole series has been about Michael from where she started as the mutineer and climbing the ranks to actually becoming captain. And then it, we have to like see the end of her story in some way. I'm not saying Michael has to die, you know, just an end to the chapter, as it were.
I can't remember how many episodes ago of this pod that we were talking about how far Michael has come. Like, the evolution of the character has been massive. Mm-hmm. You could argue that, you know, within the franchise of Trek, like, has any character changed more? Like, had such a drastic evolution in such a short amount of time? And we were thinking about having, like, an entire episode to talk about that journey and, you know, other things about Discovery since it's wrapping up. And this episode, it's almost like it was an answer to that discussion. Like, they really, you know, were shining a spotlight on that very issue of Michael's evolution by having, you know, season one Michael confronting season five Michael. So that was interesting. Like, obviously the show is also thinking about her evolution the same way we fans are.
I don't really have anything direct to say in response to that. It's a very good point. They definitely were highlighting the changes that her character has gone through, right up to the point where it was not just a fun, hey, here's a scene where it's Michael versus Michael. It was a intentional stark contrast between this is the Michael that we had at the beginning of the first season versus the Michael of the fifth season. And I commend them for doing, excuse me. I commend them for doing such a good job of highlighting the differences and reminding us how different the character is now, because it's easy to forget how far the character of Michael has evolved. And when you see them face to face and dealing with each other, it's a good reminder. I enjoyed how those scenes played out. Maybe I didn't enjoy the fight scene as much. It felt a little clumsy and awkward to me, but you are limited sometimes by trying to find a way to convincingly film a fight between the same person.
I wondered how far into the first season was that? Because I feel like, okay, so and we'll get into it when we get to that part of the episode, but the old Michael, first season Michael, when she sees our Michael, the one that we're following, she doesn't believe her story. She thinks she's a shapeshifter or something. But I feel like by the end of the first season, Michael would have seen enough that she probably would have believed it.
Well, so I think they said that she had only, like, weeks ago arrived.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Disco. So it was really, really early.
It was
okay.
Brand new because she hadn't bonded with Tilly yet. Tilly was still at the stage where she was, like, afraid of her new roommate. So this is literally, like, no more than a couple weeks after arriving.
It was okay, early.
So she's still suspicious. She's suspicious of everybody at that point. So
yeah, okay. It was early enough that Landry was still alive.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
So just within the first couple episodes of the series.
But seriously, while we're talking about Linus, when we get into the episode, but I just wanted to ask this question. When we first met him it may not be when we first met him, but that scene where they were on the elevator and he sneezed all over somebody, like, we couldn't understand anything he was saying, right? Why is he suddenly speaking?
He spoke,
but it was like another language.
No.
Because Michael said, yes, I heard that's going around, but we didn't understand what he said. It was like another language. He made like these noises or whatever, but she could understand him.
In Linus's early appearances, the audience was not privy to the universal translator.
I'm assuming
that everyone else could hear and understand Linus when he spoke, but the audience couldn't because they just thought it was funnier to say, hey, let's do a scene where you can only hear one half of the conversation. Ha, it's funny. I just thought it would be an ongoing thing,
and now we can understand everything he's saying, and he speaks all proper. You look like ravishing in red, or whatever he said.
Yeah, red is definitely your color.
Yeah, red is your color.
That's right.
Things change, you know. Once upon a time, people would actually walk to a ready room, or you know, walk anywhere. Not anymore.
Can I see? Yeah, that was weird. Can I see you in my ready room, and they have to transport there? What is it, like 10 feet away?
No. Apparently it's on a different deck because they had to go to a turbo lift.
That's the one thing I'll grant them is that yes, they have to take a turbo lift to get to the ready room, which doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to me, but it also seems odd that people will literally transport anywhere rather than walk.
Well, if you can't,
have you met people?
Yeah. Yeah, there should be an episode. They should drop a line. And it's like, well, yeah, a lot of the people on the ship are starting to gain some weight. They're not walking anywhere. I got to go to the bathroom.
Food replicators. It tastes like an ice cream sundae, but it has no calories whatsoever. Synth the food. Can we talk about the scene with Mal and Locke at the beginning before we get too far deep into the meat of the episode?
That's a good place to start at the beginning.
So Rick is talking about getting into the meat of the episode, and Sean has said like a couple times already, before we'll talk about it later on in the episode. This doesn't necessarily have to be like a linear walkthrough of the plot.
Yeah.
There's one plot there. It's an A plot only. We don't really have anything else going on other than the time cycle jumping. We'll just talk about what we want to talk about. It doesn't have to be linear. The episode wasn't, so this won't be either. Rick, what do you got about Mal and Locke?
Well, there was a very important bit of information dropped in that little scene, other than the 15 hours earlier, which I agree with Neek and with Chris elsewhere. This starting in the middle of the action and then talking about and then going back, I hate that trope with a flaming passion, and they are really leaning into it on Discovery. They always have. That's not what they did.
They didn't do that here, though.
Yeah, they did.
The episode.
No, I mean, they said 15 hours earlier, and they just showed them.
But it was not like they started.
Yeah,
and no, but it was. But I didn't even get what they were talking about until I read your recap, Neek, and I was like, oh, that's talking about. And then I watched it the second time. Oh, this is before the end of the last episode.
No, I agree. It was confusing because. Yeah, to your point, Sean, they put that, 15 hours earlier or whatever, as though they were going to do that trope. But it's like, it makes no sense to put a timestamp on something when you're telling a linear story. And, they hadn't started doing the time jumping yet. So at that point, it was linear. I mean, it was taking place, slightly before the end of last week's episode. So I guess that's what they mean. So I guess if you're like binging the show, it makes sense. But to have that at the beginning of an episode was truly bizarre.
I think that they originally filmed it to do the trope where they probably showed something and then showed that 15 hours earlier and then went to that scene. But then they heard Rick complaining about it on the episode and they decided not to do it that way.
Yeah, because they have a time scope that they can go back 3 years ago and know what I'm going to say.
No, it would have made more sense to just do the scene and then say 15 hours later and then Discovery or something.
Or
like
make
that.
It clear that they were buying goddamn time bug. I couldn't tell what they were doing.
No, that's it. The first time I watched it, I didn't catch on to that either. It seemed like a unrelated scene.
Yeah.
And it was only later that I'm like, oh, I guess they were buying that thing, but it was not clear. So like, which is so strange for like a show that's is so heavy-handed, when they do something subtle, we miss it because we're expecting everything to be, you know, super obvious. So
they did clear up the relationship a little bit, didn't they?
Well, I didn't bring this up to bitch about the thing. That was just incidental. There was a very important bit of dialogue in this because, one, I still maintain that Locke and Maul are not evil. They're just selfish because this guy did the same thing that Fred did to them. And that's why they killed him, because they were like, we were told you would try to lowball us and cheat us, and sucks to be you now. But they didn't, you know, it didn't seem clear if they had a B plan, if he wasn't going to.
No, I think they were going to murder him either way. I mean, because the poison was on the money yeah. that they gave him. So.
But if you show up with poisoned money, that's your plan A, B, and C.
Yeah. Yeah. But Maul said something very important. She said, no more bounty on our heads. So now we have a motivation for this. They are hunted. And so, you know, all along we've just been saying, okay, they're just petty criminals who have gotten in over their heads. But now things seem to be a little more desperate for them.
I'm not sure how doing one last job eliminates the bounty on their head. Unless they feel like they can pay it off or something.
I think that's what they're saying, is that this score will be big enough that they can buy off their you know, whatever they've done to earn the ire of the quadrant or whatever.
Either buy their way out of the bounty or use the profit from this particular
score to like go into hiding score. Or something.
Yeah, I've been under the my assumption has been that that there's somebody worse that we haven't seen yet, and he is making them do this. He wants this progenitor tech, and he can't do it for one reason or another. So he's making them go do it and bring it to him. And then when they do that, then he'll let them off the hook, or he's told them he'll let them off the hook for whatever.
Now, the fact that they were making out over the dying dude was a little cold. I'll grant you that.
And the guy's grabbing his leg.
Now, does anyone, because these are the type of, you know, little unimportant bonehead details that I like to focus on. Was anyone able to identify or come up with a guess on what species the buyer was?
I didn't even think about it. Tell you the truth.
Same here. Just another green dude.
You're probably going to tell us he's from the Star Trek video game or something like that.
No, although if he was, then I would recognize it and I would say so, and I would be proud to do it. But no, I think it seemed to me that this guy was sorry for all the throat clearing. He seemed reminiscent of the race that was hunting Tosk in Captive Pursuit. On DS9.
I don't remember what they look like.
Yeah, I mean,
green with scaly faces. They didn't quite look like Tosk. Tosk looked a little bit different. Okay, listeners, you can't see this on our Zoom call, but I'm delighted at watching all three of my panelists shift their attention to their screens as they looked up.
Maybe. Yeah, it's not dissimilar.
So if anyone out there, listeners, if you have better guesses as to what race this this Krenim, what was it, chronophage? Is that
chronophage,
what it was?
Chronophage, yeah.
Yes. This Krenim time bug seller, if you have any leads on what race he was, other than the race that was hunting Tosk, then...
Yeah, I see what you're saying. They look similar, but I mean, they're not the same, but we know that Disco like has changed the makeups of a lot of species. So
yeah,
it's been 900 years. Things change, like hairstyles.
Yeah. They evolve.
I get that. Latreed.
So yeah, they poison the guy because they are killers who love to kill, and killing makes them happy.
I disagree.
It warms their hearts.
I just think they don't care.
But
how is that different, Rick? Why is that distinction important to you? Because it's like if they were, like you said, they were freaking cold.
Mm-hmm.
They just murdered someone in cold blood and then didn't even care enough to like ease his suffering as he lay there dying. And yes, it was partly revenge. It was, you know, it was made clear through dialogue that this was like a bad guy.
Yeah, it's kind of like, how much do they have to do before
you're convinced that they're bad?
Yeah, you can't redeem them. Like, you want to be able to, maybe there's some kind of redemption, but before the end of the season or whatever. But, you know, how much do they have to do? It's kind of like the Breaking Bad, you know, how much does this guy have to do before you don't see him as a character that you feel bad for and you start to see him as a villain, you know?
I don't know why. I honestly don't. But I feel a sympathy for them that may be unjustified. But I feel like they are people who were pushed into the situation they're in.
Sure, but I mean, you know, not everyone who grows up, you know, being abused in an orphanage becomes a murderer.
No,
like, it's not justified.
I'm not really being clear. I guess I'm not justifying that. I'm not saying that.
You're just saying you have some sympathy for them.
I don't think they are totally, you know, horribly evil. I think that they are only.
Well, so far we've only seen them. Yeah, we've only seen them kill other bad people so far.
Yeah,
it's like Han Solo. You know, Han Solo. We saw him straight up kill a dude in the first movie, but he was killing a bad guy. Yeah. You know, Han shot first.
Han only shot.
Han shot only.
Han shot Greedo.
They being the writers have just so happened to present these characters of Mal and Locke as being in a situation where it's possible that they are doing bad things for not good reasons, not justifiable reasons, but relatable reasons. We just don't know what these reasons are yet. I think that ambiguity is what is giving you, Rick, the ability to see the possibility of them not being horrible, the possibility of them being redeemable. And I see where you're coming from. I'm taking them at face value with, you know, with what they are doing without a whole, I don't see myself really peering into the possible motivations that they have. I'm just, so far, I'm not interested enough in them to do that. It's hard for me to push past the, once again, the CW-ness of them as characters so far. And I don't think that you're weird for your take on it. I'm not looking at it the same way, because so far they have not pulled me in enough to be invested enough to care.
Okay, let me ask you a question. What do you mean by the CW-ness of them?
I think it's for teenagers.
Yeah, the characterizations and certainly the, and I don't necessarily mean this to be insulting, but the way that Mal is being performed seems like it would be more at home on a CW show than on a Star Trek show. And I'll use this episode as an example. If you either try to replay the scene in your mind, or when you get a free moment, go back and rewatch that opening scene with them.
But that doesn't explain what you mean by CW.
I'm working on it. I'm getting there. I'm getting there. And as the bug seller, he's already been poisoned and he is in his death throes and he's leaking and all that. And when Mal gives the line, "Consider this a lesson in how not to do business," you look at the, and it's the whole package. Look at the character design, the writing, and the way that that line is delivered. Now imagine that this is a scene from The Flash rather than from Star Trek. It will fit perfectly with the way she says, that incredibly transparent and predictable line.
She was repeating what he said to them.
So you just mean cheesy then?
It I don't know if that's the most accurate, but it's not far off.
Melodramatic. If you'll join me in Speculation Corner for just a second, what if
All these people jumping into my Speculation Corner just because I wasn't on the episode last week? It's everyone's stealing the corner. Okay, go ahead.
What if they are the good guys and they know that there's somebody worse that's trying to get this tech and they're just trying to get it first? What if they're Section 31 or something like that? I don't know.
Oh, God.
Then I wouldn't use all sympathy.
I'm just using Section 31 as an example. What if they're something like that?
I mean, I'm not saying this is outside of the realm of possibility. I'm saying if the show were to do that, you know, I would rage quit Star Trek for the 400th time. Again, these people are murderers. This is not justified. It doesn't matter, you know, how much your wife nags you. If you kill people, you are a murderer, Mud. Yeah. It's not funny. It's not cute. It's not redeemable. Empress Georgiou cannot be redeemed. She's a cannibal. No. There are certain actions that you take that are just not okay, and you cannot ever be the so-called good guy. And I maintain, in episode one, Maul and Locke try to murder Michael. How can we ever have sympathy for them?
Yeah,
I that's a good point. That's a fair point. I don't know. I honestly don't know why I am finding these two characters sympathetic, but
because they're just two crazy kids in love.
I feel like they're I'm not saying they're not criminals. I'm not saying they aren't guilty of horrendous crimes, but I also feel like in some way they are victims. And I think that this conversation
yes.
they had.
Yes, two things can be true. Yeah. Yes, they are victims, 100%. That has been made abundantly clear. With the connection with Book, they've gone to pains to give her a complicated backstory, a sympathetic mm-hmm. backstory that does not justify her actions.
No, and that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm not saying that it's justified.
But it's like, and I'm almost not even trying to convince you, Rick. I'm trying to convince the show writers. Because I'm so sick of that trope of them, you know, giving a redemption arc to someone irredeemable. I'm sorry. No, you can't come back from that. Just because they didn't succeed in murdering Michael doesn't mean they didn't try. So, No, it's not okay.
That's something else that I noticed in this episode. For setting them up as the, at least for now, the primary antagonists of the season. We saw one of them for just a glimpse at the end of the previous episode, and we see the both of them for one scene at the beginning of this episode. They are surprisingly absent for being the primary enemies.
Antagonists, which thank God.
I don't. Maybe if we saw a little bit more of them, if we got a little bit more exposure, and they showed us a little bit more about who these characters are, maybe I wouldn't be so. I can't say. Yeah, indifferent. I was trying to avoid saying annoyed because it's not correct. But indifferent really hits the mark. Because right now that's what I am to those two characters because we've hardly seen them. In these first four episodes, I suspect that will probably change pretty soon. But so far, they're not around a lot for being the folks that Discovery is either trying to stay ahead of or trying to catch up to. Using that to jump to now, Discovery is trying to catch up to Maul and Locke. That was something else I thought was interesting about this particular episode in that. In only the fourth episode, they put the entire scavenger hunt on hold to do a let's teach Rainer how to, once again, stealing from Neek's recap, teaching Rainer that friendship is magic for the entire episode, and they made very literally zero progress on the scavenger hunt.
That was one of the things that did bother me about the episode, was
it
was
I would a team building say that, retreat. I and would say doing that so now they're on feature, the, not a bug of the now, episode.
And now they're on the back foot. They're no longer in front of Mal and Locke. Now they're behind them.
Yeah, it was a little bit of an episode.
That raises the stakes.
It was a little bit of a filler episode, but
nothing wrong with that.
It's not something that bothered me. I just wasn't expecting it at this point in the season to put the season long story on pause for an episode this early. And then when we come out the other side of it into next week, now the positions in the race have reversed. I thought it was an interesting move.
It's like they were doing exactly what I was suggesting last week or the week before, whenever, where I was complaining that, you know, New Trek is a little bit too, or I shouldn't say New Trek because Strange New Worlds isn't like that, but that Disco is, you know, too many stories in each episode. They don't let any of the stories breathe, and they're too much focus on the main story. There are no standalone episodes. And this one exactly addressed all of that. There was one story. It was, you know, they still mention the main story, but they don't focus on it. A lot of character development. It's great stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm glad I watched it a second time, because that aspect of it, the fact that the main story was literally paused in this episode, bugged me the first time through. Then the second time, I was like, it was totally worth it.
I have a question about the logistics of this episode. What was the cause for Michael and I forget the other guy's name, Rainer.
Rainer.
Why were they not caught up in the time loop?
Because they were beaming out at exactly the same moment that the time bug activated. Okay. Yes, exactly. So the transport protected them.
Okay. I get it's
a thing.
Yeah, I don't know if it makes sense.
Yeah.
I get that insofar as it's a hand-wavy justification for them to be able to keep up with what's happening and try to counter it. But by the time the episode, I didn't think about this while I was watching the episode, but after it was over, the first thing I thought to myself was, okay, so if they had not tried to transport at that moment,
it would have been completely up to Stamets to say.
Yeah, it was just Stamets. Yeah.
And also, you know, ignoring that, trying to think about the purpose of the time bug, because I don't know what it's supposed to be doing.
The time bug is like have you ever had a randomizer virus on a computer? If you get a randomizer virus on your computer, then you open Chrome or whatever browser and you try to go to Facebook, and it will randomly send you to some other website, like any other website. It'll take you to BassProShops.com or a porn site or something like that. And then you try to, no, that's not where I wanted to go. You try to go to Facebook. Well, now you're at Tupperware.com or something. And it's just to cause chaos.
It was a delay tactic. Like at the end, when Adira comes in and they're like, oh, you know, I just lost 6 hours. It was just a method of delaying them for 6 hours or however long the time bug lasts, so that Locke and Mal can have a head start, an advantage.
Yeah, but what is actually happening to the ship if the bug is working as it's supposed to? Is it sending the ship through time and space and all the people on board the ship through time and space, and they land in another time in another location and they just don't realize it? And then they jump in time again. They're inhabiting their old bodies at a different time, at a different place.
Yeah.
But they don't know that anything's different.
Yeah, the ultimate trap that if you don't know you're trapped, you don't try to get out.
Yeah,
they're just reliving moments over and over, so that, and randomly, they're reliving all kinds of different moments. And it's just to keep you busy while we're doing something else over here. And it could take you years to figure your way out of it if you ever do.
And that's what Zora said when they got to the future with Zora, that Zora said, you know, y'all didn't get out in time.
Yeah.
By the time we figured it out and escaped the bug, the brain had destroyed Starfleet.
That reminds me, I want to talk about Zora in a few minutes.
It was just hard for me to conceptualize what the rest of the crew was experiencing or going through. It's almost as if everyone was Sam Beckett quantum leaping into their past selves.
But not being aware of it.
Yeah, but with no awareness at all.
Yeah, it's like this moment right now, if somebody had put a time bug in my theater, this moment right now would be as real to me as it was the first time we did it 150 years ago. but nobody is aware of it. So it's not like, oh, wow, now I'm doing this. Oh, wow, now I'm doing that. It's just you're just living your life. You have no idea that this is the second, third, fourth, 100th time you've been through this particular piece of time. But because we have magic Stamets and Michael and Rayner managed to be beaming at exactly the right time, because basically Star Trek has always been a melodrama. You have to have these coincidences or the stories don't work.
Right. And it just seems to me that that time bug might work better as a weapon to take your enemies off the board. If once the bug interfaces with the ship, send the ship and all its inhabitants, oh, I don't know, 50 years into the future, and just leave them there. Don't go jumping around back and forth through time and space. Just jump them somewhere completely foreign to them and strand them there. And
but then you leave them
out of your way.
Yeah, but then you leave them knowing that happened, and that gives them they'll always science a way out of it. They'll figure out a way to get back. So I think that transporters have caused so many problems in Star Trek, they should have been outlawed a long time ago.
But they can't outlaw them because they're essentially magic. I mean, they've created a lot of problems, but solved an equal amount of problems.
Well, that's why I laughed when you said a hand-wavy thing. I'm like, the transporter is the ultimate hand-wavy Star Trek thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you need them, they don't work. Mm-hmm. And then when they do work, they're causing problems.
Exactly. We can't afford to land the ship every week. What can we do? And then expansion.
Let's swirl some glitter in a glass of water, and there you go. Now we can do anything. All right. I won't stick on the logistics of the time bug anymore. That's just something that occurred to me, just not fully understanding what it's supposed to be doing when everything goes great. But Sean did mention something, and I want to hear his take on it, because I wonder if it's going to be similar to mine. You had something that you wanted to say about Zora.
Yes. When they go to the future and Zora says, you all died decades ago. Is this the timeline that we saw in that short trek? And now that
was my interpretation.
Have they changed? Now that they changed things, that timeline doesn't exist anymore. So that short trick doesn't happen.
I believe that is, I think that's what happened. Yes.
Or it does happen, but it just happens in an alternate timeline. It's, you know, the J.J. Abrams movies, everything can be explained as, well, that's an alternate timeline. So it still happens. It just happens elsewhere.
I think that y'all work way too damn hard to make the short treks fit into something.
Well, put it on the screen if it doesn't mean anything.
Okay, the animated, the one with the dots was... anyway.
It all matters.
I am one of the worst canonistas on this podcast, and I'm like, it was just a cute little story, and it didn't have to actually... But also, you know, Zora was listening to Doris Day, so...
What does that have to do with anything?
When they got to the future, Zora was listening to Doris Day, which
right?
came about from Kraft coming aboard the ship.
Mm-hmm.
In the short trek.
Mm-hmm.
But if that is the timeline where that happens, it hasn't happened yet, because in that short trek, Zora said that they died 1,000 years ago.
Yeah,
and then she just said, "You all died decades ago." So
I put it together in my head. thusly and pretty quickly, because Calypso is like my favorite of the short treks when they tried that experiment. Initially, I was anticipating, because that short trek happened before the end of, I think it was like between seasons 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm,
yeah. That short trek was certainly before Discovery traveled to the 32nd century. So when Zora was talking about how long she had been alone, I think it had been like 1,000 years. I thought that they were going to eventually go back and explain how Zora from the 23rd century was hidden somewhere, and then 1,000 years later, Kraft finds her. But now, I think that when we were watching the short trek, the Calypso short trek, that it took place in, well, say, roughly the 42nd century, maybe 41st century. And I will just have to, you know, just a quick and dirty retcon on why the Discovery looked like the pre 32nd century refit Discovery. It looked like the 23rd century Discovery.
Now, it wasn't Discovery A. It was just Discovery.
Right. Yeah. I was just going to ask, we're watching the 1031A right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So Zora decided to revert back to what she looked like before leaving the 23rd century. That's fine. But the time bug did its thing. The progenitor tech got out and the Federation was laid waste, and Zora was left with all her crew dead. And hundreds of years later, Kraft shows up and she falls in love, and then he leaves, and now she's still alone all by herself. Now this episode with Michael and Rayner and Stamets finding a way to thwart the time bug has erased that future timeline from Calypso. But I think up until this episode, we realize now that what we were seeing in Calypso was hundreds of years after the 32nd century adventures of Discovery.
Yeah, so it was way, way, way in the future.
Yeah. And people will say, oh, but Discovery looked different. It looked like before they traveled through time. Ah, shut up.
Yeah.
Because I want Calypso to be real somehow, somewhere. Because I love that short.
Yeah. Like I said, I think it still is. It's just, it's an alternate timeline now. I think they've retconned it enough. So, yeah, I just wondered about that, because Zora being by herself and saying that you all died, I was like, okay, well, this is where the whole Calypso thing came from. But
and now we know that it took Zora like less than 30 years to develop a habit of just listening to really old music and being sad all the time. that was me and Sean talking about the potential implications of this episode on Calypso. Do you guys have any additional thoughts other than you guys are reading way too much into it?
That's pretty much it.
That's all.
No,
you got.
I don't think there's any such thing as reading too much into anything. All things should be read into the point where it's ludicrous. And so what I'm now thinking is, like, how dumb or short-sighted is Zora? Like, she doesn't just build herself an android body and then go live with whatever humanoids she can find, or go live with whatever non-corporeal life forms she can find. Like, why is she just hanging out there all alone instead of flying around looking for other life forms?
You would think she could at least download her consciousness into one of the dots or something so that she could go off and do something.
Exactly.
Hell, with going into one of the dots, she could
got
just
a ship. Well, look for another Tin Man or something.
She
could
ship.
Access Stamets and Culber's files and create a Gollum body for herself and download into that. She could be able
exactly. To. Well, that's what I'm saying.
So this, okay, I'll read into that a little bit further. I think this illustrates just how deeply Zora cares for and loves the crew that is on board her. That once they are gone, she completely gives up. her spirit is broken. She is too devastated to even consider trying to literally rebuild herself and start over again. And that makes it even sadder.
Yeah, that's, I mean, because in my head, I mean, at any time she could go, why they haven't experimented or used some storyline since they created Zora, when they can't go into the holodeck and talk to Zora in a human form or whatever. I don't know why they haven't done that. I would have done that already.
Well, why and would you do that?
With the doctor technology, she could... I mean, the holograms are all over the whole ship, right?
So, right, but why does Zora have to have a humanoid form? Like, why is that the only valid type of life? Like, it's perfectly valid to be a disembodied voice. Like, because Zora is the ship, right?
Exactly.
And that's a perfectly valid life form to be, which is why I suggested, you know, if she doesn't want to take on a humanoid life, you know, go live with the Medusans, go live with the Tin Man and Tam Elrond or whatever. Like, the possibilities are endless.
Some XBs out there probably exist. She can buddy up with a Borg sphere if she wants
to. But I think that Zora is whole, she could do.
Yeah, I agree with you, Neek, in that she is, Zora is the ship. That's all she wants to be, is the ship. She's not a ship that wants to be a person. She just wants to be who she is, and who she is now Discovery. And also, I think that if she were to create a holographic avatar that could interact with the crew when they want to talk to Zora, she appears as a person that would see. And I've never played the games, but that would seem a little too Cortana for me.
Or Andromeda.
Well, I'm pretty sure Cortana is from Halo, I think. I haven't played the games, nor have I watched the show. But
there's a lot of... Zora came about in, you know, in season 2 and 3, they were kind of experimenting a lot with bringing aspects of things that happened in the Star Trek novels and bringing them into some sort of fruition in the show. Like, they brought in Control and all that kind of stuff. And Zora, there is a ship in the New Frontier novels. There is a ship that is sentient. Their ship in that novel series is sentient. And I think that they were, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's put that in here. And I think that's the only thought that they had.
No. Michael Chabon said when he wrote the episode, his goal was to create a short trek that was far enough in the future that there was no connection to anything that came before. That's where the whole Zora thing came from. He was trying to just create a little isolated, cute story set in a set that existed, so they didn't have to spend money on building new sets. But that was far enough ahead that he could do something interesting with it that wouldn't have to follow canon.
Mm-hmm.
Then he didn't know. He did not know his audience.
Well, I mean, in that he succeeded, because that is what he did when he created it. But then the writers and producers of Discovery decided to bend and form the canon.
Right. You're right. Absolutely.
With what he created in mind. So they decided to point things in the direction of the short trek that he created. And I am here for it.
Yeah. But the first time I heard Zora on Discovery, I was thrilled. But I also think that, you know, I don't think we're going to need to try to figure out how to plug the problem with Edward into canon, or the Dots animated episode, or, you know, some of it works, some of it doesn't. And
you just wait.
there will be some. Okay, they'll find a way to reference Edward and his unfortunate triple end in the Section 31 movie.
Okay, so Michael and Rayner and Stamets are aware of the fact that they're being sent through time. How did that piece of equipment go with them?
The same way that their clothes went with them.
Which piece of equipment, sorry?
The little frisbee that would destroy the bug that they had to gather all the pieces for, unless they had to rebuild it every time they jumped, and they just didn't show us that.
Well, I guess you just have to hold on to it. I mean, why did
it was only one jump
go with them?
Because they built it, and then the next reset is when they fixed it. So it was just one jump that it went with them. But I think it was the same reason their clothes went with them, because it was in their possession.
I suspect that if I go back and watch the episode again, I think it was a chronoton stabilizer. Don't quote me on that. I think after it was built and they had to wait until the next cycle to use it, if we pay attention, it's probably either Michael or Rayner that is holding it.
Because
they are physically traveling to the different locations. Stamets is only going mentally because his body and his uniform and all that stuff is just whatever he happens to jump into when they move to the next cycle. Yeah. But Burnham and Rayner are actually going there. So as the recap pointed out, their uniforms go with them every time. Not that anyone fucking notices. That bothered me. It obviously bothered Neek reading the recap. But that was really getting under my skin. How so many people did not immediately say, "What the hell are you wearing? That looks ridiculous." It's uneven. One side is longer than the other at your zipper.
Yeah. It's a completely new design, and everyone just like completely until Bryce points it out. Everyone is just like, okay, mm-hmm. like weird, very, very strange.
Yeah,
maybe not when you realize how incompetent the average Starfleet officer is.
And every ship in the new Trek era seems to have its own uniform. So
that's what I was going to say. Rather than the incompetence of like most Starfleet security officers, I think it's more of the did I miss another uniform rollout? Son of a bitch! This is the third one in a row that I'm late for.
I remember Geordi just showed up in a uniform from an alternate timeline, and nobody noticed that. Did we mention that the Karinams are not new to Star Trek? Have we talked about the Year of Hell?
They're from the Delta Quadrant bad guys.
The Krenim Imperium. I think it was the Imperium. I think
from Voyager. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I like the references to the temporal Cold War, because every time we've ever talked about the temporal Cold War,
Mm-hmm. This is the temporal war that was.
It's a temporal war.
When they first got to the 32nd century.
When we talked about the temporal war before, like when we were in Enterprise and all that kind of stuff, they're always talking about something that hasn't happened yet. Now Rayner's talking about the temporal war as something that happened a long time ago. So, mm-hmm.
Somewhere between the 24th and 32nd century, rather than a temporal Cold War, there was a temporal Hot War. And it hadn't really occurred to me until watching this episode and Rayner mentioned the temporal war as where these Krenim time bugs came from. One, I'd loved the name drop of the Krenim, mm-hmm. especially folding it into a temporal war. That's exactly where those guys would be at home. It was a great connection to make. And it also made me wonder how much fun maybe not necessarily an ongoing series because it might get tired, but another made for TV Star Trek streaming movie, or maybe a mini series.
Yeah, I'd love to see some of those
spinoff that dives into the temporal war.
I'd love to see some of the weapons that they would come up with, and like temporal. This is a temporal time bomb. This is a temporal grenade, and see how these things would work. Throw a grenade at somebody, and it just makes them go into the past or something. You know? Mm-hmm.
The costume designers and the set designers for a Star Trek Temporal Wars miniseries would have an absolute blast. And all of us canon files who love to see the progression of the technology and what uniforms are used in what time period and what they looked at. It would be so dense with Easter eggs. Yeah, people would be picking apart that miniseries for years, and I like the sound of it. I'm getting more excited at the notion of a Temporal Wars miniseries the more I talk about it.
Rick's getting angry just thinking about it. He's getting angry at a show that doesn't even exist.
I'm not getting angry. I'm just thinking of that would be almost worse than a Section 31 series to me.
I'm just a person that really likes time travel stories. I've even thought about starting a podcast where we just talk about time travel movies and stuff. But yeah, I mean, I would be there for that.
Although, so punching people wearing helmets is a stupid idea.
I made a note of that. I put that in my notes. Punching helmets. Why does that happen?
I mean, there were a couple times they punched him in the throat. That was like, all right, fine. But a lot of those punches went straight to the helmet.
That's kind of what helmets are for, to protect your head. So the number of Emerald Chain thugs that should still be standing, and the number of knuckles that should be broken on Rainer and Michael, they got it wrong. Like, they got it wrong.
I have a tech to tech question for Rick, because he knows a lot about Star Trek tech. The warp bubble is what protects us from the effects of relativity.
Yes.
Is that the first time they've ever said that? I thought the warp bubble is just protects them from being torn apart because they're traveling so fast.
Well, the way the warp bubble works is the way warp drive works is the warp engines generate a warp. They warp space.
Yeah.
And they move this region of warped space at faster than light velocities. Inside that bubble, the ship is literally stationary. It is not moving. So the ship is not affected by the time dilation of the incredible velocities that the area of space they're in is moving. Because there are no theoretical limits on how fast space can move. In fact, space is expanding faster than the speed of light. Don't ask me to explain the physics of that, because I barely understand it. But the universe is expanding, and the further away you go, the faster it's going. And it is literally expanding faster than the speed of light. But because we're inside the area that's expanding, the speed of light is the same for us. Anyway, so that's basically what a warp bubble is. So the ship is stationary. The need for inertial dampeners and structural integrity fields is all sublight stuff, because impulse speed is still way faster than any speeds our rockets can generate. And if there were no inertial dampeners, even accelerating to full impulse, which I think is like 0.75C or something like that, the whole crew would be tomato paste on the back wall of the ship. So they still need the inertial dampeners for sublight stuff. Once they go to warp, it doesn't matter, because the ship is, for all intents and purposes, not moving.
Hmm. The bubble that they're inside is moving.
Yes.
But the ship itself is not.
Space itself is moving.
Yeah. The analogy, because Star Trek what Star Trek loves to do is they present a really weird, like, sci-fi tech idea, and then someone has to dumb it down with an analogy that the audience can relate to. Mm-hmm. So the analogy that I come up with is, when I'm traveling in my car, the car is going, you know, 70 miles an hour down the freeway, but myself in the air inside the cabin of the car, and the air inside the car is not whipping past my face at 70 miles an hour. My car is my warp bubble.
It doesn't really work, but okay.
Well, it's not exactly the same, but it's something
if you have a bee in the car with you, it's not plastered to the back windshield the whole time that you're driving.
Well, that's because you're all moving at the same time. But anyway, by dropping out of the warp bubble, but still moving, because that's the whole thing, by collapsing the warp bubble instead of slowing down so the ship drops into normal space with a relative velocity of nothing, the ship would then be moving at superluminal speeds in real space, which the time dilation would cause everything on board that ship to be moving relative to the universe much slower. The time moves much slower the faster you go.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why there would be time for them to neutralize the bug before whatever they were putting in there aged to the point of disintegration.
Yeah, time dilation only exists in Star Trek when it's convenient, because if it did, then every time they went back to Earth, it would be 1,000 years later.
Yeah, exactly. That's why they came up with the warp drive.
Yeah. It was the type of technological explanation for solving the problem of the episode that I knew that I wasn't necessarily going to grasp all the details of it, but I found it interesting enough that I just went with it. The fact that they that they used the theoretical, Star Trek science of warp drive and relativistic speeds. That was the solution to the problem. I thought it was clever. I wouldn't be able to explain it to literally anyone, but what I caught through the dialogue, I thought it was clever. And Rayner got a Picard hand.
It was remarkably accurate to real science for Star Trek.
for Star Trek, yes.
Yeah, right. He was able to withstand that a lot better than Picard ever was, because Picard yanked his hand out so fast because it was so painful.
Picard wasn't expecting it. Rayner went in knowing what would happen. He was choosing that pain.
Yeah.
He was
but we didn't see the fingernails. Picard had the really long fingernails and stuff. Rayner, they didn't show his fingernails.
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't do that.
Yeah.
They missed a potential Easter egg by not giving him super long nails along with everything else.
And Burnham said, go to sick bay and Colbert can fix that. He's just going to de-age his hand.
Apparently.
Run him through the transporter. That's what everybody else does.
Yeah. They have little hand transporters.
Yeah.
De-age.
Take some cells from his good hand, put them in the computer. You flip them horizontal like in Photoshop, and then you transport his old hand off his body and back again using the flipped cells.
He's going to have two left hands.
No, that's why you flip it horizontal. You flip it. And then he gets the proper hand. Flip it.
And then they go on an away mission 8 years later, and they find out that there's a copy of his hand laying there. Wearing and there's a yellow TARDIS uniform
next to it.
Yeah, which he can then turn it into a copy. Okay.
Thank you, Thing. So I think this episode deserves an Emmy for editing for the fight between Michael and Michael. I think that was one of the best split. I don't even know if they're using split screen anymore. The editing of that fight was brilliant, I thought.
I think you stepped out of the room when Scott was saying the exact
Scott was talking about how bad it was.
Well, I wasn't, not necessarily that it was bad, but I did think that parts of the fight seemed a little clunky and awkward. And honestly, I don't know if it was because of what they were having to do to like shoot around the, or to shoot the proper angles for the stunt double.
Whoever involve stunt doubles, so they're always using clever angles.
Yeah, but like I say, I don't know if it was because they had to shoot around the Michael that wasn't Michael, or if it's just the way they decided to film a martial arts fight sequence in 2024 where everything's moving around quite
a lot. I think it's the latter, because like neither Michael was Sonequa Martin Green. I'm sure they were both stunt doubles.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it was great. I thought even a second time, the only time it didn't hold up was the last scene where Michael is lowering Michael to the deck unconscious. And if you look really hard, the matting of clearly the one on the floor is the stunt double with Michael's head superimposed. And you can see a little bit of artifact around it. But I think overall that whole sequence worked really well.
I think they did a really good job of making Michael look like first season Michael. Yeah. Brought the hair back and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it hasn't been that long. It's not like they had to de-age or anything. It's only been, what, 5-6 years, something like that?
Yeah.
So, the dreads are a wig anyway, so it's not like they had to hide them or anything.
I want to jump backward for a minute to... I want to return to the concept of relativistic speeds. Mm-hmm. And Rick, this will be another question for Rick because he's the one that knows all this stuff. Considering the effect that breaking the warp bubble had on Discovery in this episode, if we talked about this a couple weeks ago, I don't remember it, and I'll apologize if we're repeating stuff, but would it really be so smooth a transition in that first episode for Michael to disconnect from Mal and Locke's ship and exit their warp bubble and return to normal space?
I don't know a whole lot about the physics of exiting a warp bubble, obviously
it was hard to know about the physics of something that, doesn't exist.
Yeah. I kind of think that if an unprotected person just in a spacesuit were to suddenly find themselves in normal space moving superluminally, they would be turned to atoms in a heartbeat or less.
But that's a magic suit.
Obviously, that's not the case. That whole scene was a little weird. There are whole books, especially some of the earliest Star Trek novels. There's a James Blish wrote one called Spock Must Die that I read as a teenager, and they went in depth into ships fighting at warp and how it shouldn't happen and trying to push a photon torpedo through the warp field, and it just the physics of how ships should interact at warp are beyond bizarre, but for the dramatic purposes of a TV show, they have to be able to. I don't know why the Ares tractor beam was going to cause a problem, but Burnham could just jump off and just parkour into normal space. This episode was much, much closer to actual scientific fact as we know it now in dealing with relativity and stuff. You know, they were like, this is going to tax our integrity fields to their limit. And they did. And you know, I thought there may should have been a few more explosions or something, but it was fine. Burnham jumping out unprotected, and that didn't track for me, but you know, it's Star Trek. So
it's as Chris and Albie on their Trexplorations podcast would say, that's a scene that bumped you. That's what they say. If it's something that like it doesn't sit right, or if it takes them out of the show, it bumps them. I may steal that.
Okay. And I don't think it took me out of the show, because they do stuff like that all the time. So if I worried about every time they violated scientific reality.
Yeah, you would have been out a long time ago. Yeah.
In like 67.
I mean, I have to go back to freaking warp particles in Voyager's first season. I was like, what?
Yeah.
Does anyone have any other particular scenes, notes, happenings from this episode that they wanted to bring up?
John brought this up, and I was going to bring it up too. The end of the episode, before they broke free, where first season Michael and Reese are holding Rayner and Stamets at phaser point. Why the hell didn't Arium just call down to engineering, say, Burnham, stand down, it's cool? That would have solved the whole thing in 5 seconds. They could have got on with the mission.
Okay, so
in 5 seconds.
Yeah,
I mentioned this on the chat, but since when does first or second season Michael obey orders? Michael never obeyed orders. That's what most of the plots were about in the first couple of seasons.
Yeah.
So at least Arium calling down and saying stand down isn't going to make Michael do jack. She's going to keep doing what she wanted to do.
But at least it should have. I mean, all, you know, Burnham had their trust on the bridge. All she had to go was, you know, I am down there holding them at phaser point. Arium, do something.
Do we want to talk about the stupidity of her convincing Arium by telling her something she's going to do?
Yeah. You're going to die.
Like, it that was, made no sense.
Yeah, it was.
You know what? You're right. I will die one day.
It was a very convenient way. It was an overly convenient way for Michael to convince the bridge to trust her. But I think that the writers did it the way they did, mainly, and I don't necessarily love the feeling of this, I think they chose that particular method to pluck the heartstrings of the viewers who cried when Arium died in season two.
Like all two of them?
Hey.
Damn.
All right. Me and who else?
I just like, I'm not trying to diss Arium. I just feel it was an unearned death. Like it didn't really have that much impact because I don't know. Maybe it's me. Like, I just feel like Disco has never managed to make me care about characters the way TNG could. I don't know. There is so many episodes of TNG where they like they introduce a character. You know, you get one episode, so like this person is on screen for maybe 30 minutes and I care deeply about them. Like the Inner Light, you know, I care deeply about all Picard's family members. And yet, you know, Arium had a couple episodes and I just do not care. Like there's just no emotional attachment.
Yeah, because when they killed Arium, they acted like they were killing a main character on the show. But there's secondary characters.
Yeah, that's it. They tried. I mean, she had an episode, like the episode where they killed her was an episode all about her.
Yeah, yeah, they tried to
create something. And so, like, it should have worked because, like, again, TNG, what was that episode? Lower Decks, where they killed off the, I can't remember her name, the Bajoran girl. Yeah, Cino Jackson. Like, I was deeply affected by that. I deeply cared. So it's like, it can be done. I just don't feel like they achieved that with Arium. Maybe just because her death felt so cheap. It felt so unnecessary. Like, it really felt as though there was another way out of that problem.
There were a lot of ways, other ways out, yeah.
Yeah, so it just felt so tacked on. It felt so, like I said, unearned. Maybe just because of the way TV in general has evolved, like in, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, if you, well, again, she wasn't a main character, but I don't know. They kill off people so often now that it loses impact, basically. Yeah. Like when they killed off Cornwall, like it was.
And that was a stupid one too.
Well, yes, exactly. That's my point, because they just, it's like they went through the list of characters and were like, okay, which one are we going to kill off? Like, guys, you don't need to kill anyone off. That's not a necessary thing. Like, why do writers now think that they, it's like ever since they broke that taboo of killing off important characters, they just can't get away with it. They can't not do it, I mean.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, now that Game of Thrones has been a thing, they're like, well, well, you know, we have to kill someone. It's like, no, you don't. You can tell impactful stories in other ways. And I'm not saying they shouldn't ever kill anyone off. It's just like, make me care. Make it earn.
Yeah. Well, like with Cornwell, her death didn't make me sad. It pissed me off because it was so bad. There was no point to it.
Well, that's my point. That's kind of how I felt about the Arium's death, where it was just like, it was just dumb. It just didn't really make sense. And so them addressing that in this episode, except, you know, doubling down on it, being like, oh, you really sacrificed yourself and, oh, we care so much. You know, we love you so much, Arium. It's like, really? Because it's just like they're telling, not showing.
Well, and then they put a point on it when afterwards the coda where Oa was like, I wouldn't have done that. So I think even the writers are, I'm, you know, one thing we don't get to see on this side of the TV screen is what sort of edicts are coming down from above.
Yeah, of course.
So maybe some of this really stupid shit is producers going, all right, we need this for that reason.
Yeah.
Write it.
Well, that's it. And it's like, you know, whether, you know, we often say on this show, like, oh, the writer's this, the writer's that. I think what we mean by that is the powers that be. Because we don't know, you know, which individual writer made which individual decision. I think we just mean as a whole, the people making the show, you know, whether it was a producer, a writer, a combination, you know, an issue of too many cooks, you know, whatever it is, these are problems.
Yeah. And also something, and I've mentioned this in previous episodes when it was more current, but we also have to keep in mind, this stuff was all written pre-strike. And part of the reason the writers struck was because they were being treated like shit. And so there may be underlying just, you know, people overworked, underpaid, trying to get scripts in under unreasonable deadlines and just pumping out shit to get it filmed.
Yeah, I'm not trying to insult anyone in particular. I'm not trying to say they're bad writers or anything like that. I mean, I fully understand that these... I mean, I've worked in a job before. Yeah, it's fucking hard. Like, it's pretty much impossible to make a good product or, you know, to do things properly when you've got some a-hole breathing down your neck. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But, you know, that doesn't excuse anything. I mean, you know, the point of a podcast like this is not to say, like, man, I wonder how hard it's been for all these, you know, people working their jobs. It's like, no, we're criticizing a TV show. And
yeah,
if we don't like something, we point it out.
Yeah. And that wasn't meant to be a criticism. I'm just thinking.
Explaining why. Yeah.
Yeah. Because we know that these writers can do really great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So when something subpar happens, it stands out a little more, I think.
Anybody have any other final thoughts before we wrap it up?
Not about this episode, but there was something you guys talked about a couple episodes back that I wanted to mention since I'm here. You talked about the Section 31 movie that's coming up and the fact that Rachel Garrett's going to be part of it.
Yeah.
I have a theory. I mentioned it on the chat. So I think that Rachel Garrett it's going to be said that she survived the Enterprise C battle where she was supposed to have died, and she's like being held captive by the Klingons, and Section 31 has to go and save her, and now she becomes an agent for Section 31. It's my speculation corner for that.
I would really hate that, but fine.
I mean, I expected that Rick would hate the notion.
I mean, that's the only reason.
I just don't think they're going to go that way. But
why would I hate it? Because
I don't think we're going to see the Enterprise C, is what I'm saying. I don't think, unless we see like the end of that battle or something like that. I don't think the Enterprise C is going to be part of that series.
Well, I think the Rachel Garrett that we see is going to be before she takes command of the Enterprise C. I think it's take place well before that episode. But Rick, you've been interrupted like four times.
Yeah, so you think. I interrupt people all the time too. So sorry, I was just looking up. John has some things he wants us to read before we wrap this up. Because I'm already sick of the trope of such and such. We thought they were dead, but now they're an agent for Section 31. All right. It's
is
no
that
secret.
A trope? Who has done that?
Well, we've got a transporter clone Boimler. I hate Section 31 with a flaming passion. And
right, we all know that.
Yeah, we all know that.
You're saying it's
I would
a
love it. I would love it
that
if
someone
Boimler
dies
was part of
and
Section
then it turns out they're working
the
for 31. I'm like, who? Who's an
you're
example
right. That's,
of that?
You're right. That is not a trope. But
it's Boimler's clone is part of Section 31, and the books say that Tucker didn't actually die.
Yeah, but the books are nonsense. The books are not canon.
Yeah, I'm not saying that's canon. I'm saying that's when it's happened.
Words.
And that,
the books
that kind of bleeds
wonderful.
In.
Well, the books may be good reads, but they're not canon. So you cannot use them to defend anything.
The reason I would hate it is because I love the character of Rachel Garrett. I would not like Rachel Garrett being part of Section 31. I don't want any character I like being part of Section 31. I don't like Section 31. So,
Rick, are you part of Section 31? Is that what this is?
I'm not wearing a black comm badge now.
I think that when this movie comes along, I think that the Section 31 that we're going to see is going to be different than what we saw in Deep Space Nine. I don't think that it's going to be the whole... we can do whatever we want. Nobody can stop us. I don't think it's going to be that kind of an organization.
I think it's going to be exactly that kind of organization.
Yeah, it is
going
to be that.
In Discovery, when Section 30, I mean, everybody knew that Section 31 was a thing. In Deep Space Nine, nobody knew that they existed. You know, Section 31's walking around with their black badges on, and you know, what's his face is throwing it in Pike's face and say that gives me the authority.
Also, we talked about that in the first season. because it was kind of stupid, except that the Discovery was a test bed for new classified technologies. So it made sense for there to be Section 31 openly on the ship, because it was presumably before they went underground or whatever. I still, you know, I'm trying not to bitch about Section 31. I'm trying to fold it in because it's a reality I can't get rid of. So Discovery was established as a test bed for new technologies. That's why it had the spore drive. That's why it had the holographic communication devices. And that's why we had a bunch of assholes wearing black comm badges on the ship. And then,
all right, well, we will keep our wild speculations about Section 31 contained to the upcoming movie about Section 31.
I pray that when that movie comes out, that it is so good
that Rick
just falls in love with Section 31.
You just starts, keep on praying.
And he starts writing fan fiction about 31.
All right, John said...
He gets a 31 tattoo on his arm right here.
Yeah, that's not happening. Okay, John said about this episode, I loved it. Easily my favorite of the season so far. Subtle calls to lower decks with time bubble rapid aging caves and Prodigy with conical time jumps. Okay, I don't remember that, but I'll believe him. I liked the talking down young Burnham scene, but it was kind of dumb. She'd already convinced Arium. Arium should have just told young Burnham to stand down.
Yeah,
we already brought that up.
We already talked about that. Also, my question about how do coordinates work on something written hundreds of years ago, and my comments about your comments on the previous episode. I'm not sure what exactly
I think that what he's talking about, because he said something a couple of days ago in the chat. I think he's talking about when time travel happens on the ship. How do they take into account the fact that the ship is in a different place than it was when they time? But I think that's the whole thing. They're moving through time and space.
Yeah, I tried to do some research on this. I dug out my encyclopedia, and I also looked on Memory Alpha. I thought I had seen in one of the many tech manuals an explanation that coordinates had a time, part of it was a time thing. I can't find any documentation on this, but any sort of galactic coordinate is going to have to include some sort of timestamp that the ship's computer can extrapolate from, because everything's moving. You know, on a short time period, you know, on you know, days, weeks, years, whatever, there's not a significant change, but over 800 years, everything is going to be in a different place, but everything moves in a predictable manner. So like what we saw in stellar cartography in Generations, you know, there is every ship keeps track of every place it has to go, and gravitational effects and stuff are taken into account. So the coordinates of a place, because coordinates, there's a difference between coordinates of a planet and coordinates of transporting and coordinates for set a course for. They still have three numbers. Actually, in space, you need four. But anyway, there would have to be a time factor in there as well. And so presumably the ship's computer can say, you know, 800 years ago, this is where this was. But now this has drifted this far in 800 years, so that's where we have to go.
Yeah, I think they also have their computers are all updated now, so they have all the new coordinates. Even though the coordinates do change, theoretically, they change day after day. He also got into a conversation with Chris a couple of days ago about, like, Back to the Future, when the DeLorean disappears and goes 30 years into the past. The Earth wasn't in the same place 30 years ago. So why doesn't the DeLorean just come out in the middle of space somewhere?
That's the old time travel joke.
It's a movie.
Scott,
that's all I got to say about that.
Yeah, things started to get fuzzy, and I heard a ringing in my ears, but I'm back now.
Rick's Science Corner is done.
we each get our own corner. Neek, what's your corner going to be? I get speculation. Rick gets science. What do you get?
I get to plug and get on out of here.
Neek, shut the fuck up, corner.
I have no notes. That's pretty much what I heard too. Okay, if you're in such a rush, then Neek, where can people find you online?
You can read.
My God, you're taking too long. We got to wrap this up. Rick, where can people find you online?
You can find me reading Neek's Neekcaps at recaps at superanemic.com.
I was going to go back to her. Jeez, I'm not a monster. You can
find me reading Neek's Neekcaps.
I'm not the villain. I was going to let her have her plug.
I'm the villain here.
All right, for real this time. Neek, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me at superanemic.com. And because For All Mankind has been, has been renewed. No, it's on hiatus. I recently did a special couple of episodes about Constellation, and coming up soon will be a special episode about the three-body problem. So look for Moon Show.
Moon Show.
By the way, I love that your gingerbread Moon Show sculpture is still there on your table.
It smells so good. It makes the whole house smell like gingerbread.
It's Christmas all year long.
Okay, and now for real. This time, Rick, where can people find you on the internet?
Find me lurking all over the Alliance here on that Star Trek podcast, occasionally on Captain Game Show, on Super Cosmic Potato, the Super Fan Talk podcast. And once I get my life back next week, I will resume my super secret project.
Once you get your life back,
I'm work is very busy right now.
I get it.
All right, and Boss Man, where can people find you and the network online?
You can find the network at infinitepotato.com, infinitepotatoalliance.com, excuse me. Other than that, you can find me occasionally sitting here talking about Star Trek. Other than that, you can find me at work. That's about it.
As for myself, in addition to being the host of this particular show, you can find me occasionally on Captain Game Show, Cosmic Potato, What's Your Headcanon, and Moon Show. And if you don't want to listen to me anymore, then you can feel free, please, to visit my website, www.planetrisecreative.com, and check out some of the graphic artwork that I do for fun and profit. That's going to do it for this episode. We want to thank everyone for listening, for downloading, and hopefully subscribing to this show. Feel free to find us on Facebook or on infinitepotatoalliance.com. Leave some feedback, send some emails, let us know what you think of the show. Give us some of your speculations for later on in the season, and join us next week as we discuss Star Trek Discovery Season 5, Episode 5, titled Mirrors.
Oh, no.
That's right, Mirror Universe Show, bitches.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of That Star Trek Podcast. You can contact us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can send us an email at thatstartrekpodcast@gmail.com. Help the show grow by giving us a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcatcher. Be sure to join us again next time on That Star Trek Podcast.
Someone's setting off fireworks and my dog is farting. It could
be
either.
I'm leaving that in the show.